From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble, and on today's show, an artist who designs golf courses and an art center that designs dreams. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call.
What'll we do?
All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, the Harrison Center expands its mission beyond pure arts into social activism. But first, over the years on The Art of the Matter, we've featured people who are creative in more than one field, and today's first conversation brings us another example. Ron Kern is a photographer who says his mission is to, quote, reveal the spiritual essence of his environment, end quote. But he's also a third-generation golf course architect who uses his artistry to respect the existing character of the land as he designs. Contributor Pete Brown talked with Ron about these different artistic roles.
Ron, you've been a gracious host out here today and taken us around to see the process of the way things are evolving here at Old Oakland. As you go back in time, what planted a seed of interest in your mind about golf? I mean, I know you played in high school, but how did it even start even before that?
Well, I've been around golf course architecture since basically I was 10 years old.
Okay.
1968. My dad was a civil engineer and designed subdivisions, and then he was asked to design Brookshire Golf Club, and he said, well, I'm not a golf course architect. We need to hire Bill Diddle, who is a great golden age golf course architect that lived in Carmel. And so Bill and my dad designed Brookshire, and then Bill said, Gary, I think you're pretty good at that. And that was my first exposure to it, was actually going out when I was 10 years old and laying out the golf course at Brookshire. And then my dad became a golf course architect. I went to school for civil engineering and worked at the Indiana Department of Highways for 6 years as a road designer, bridge designer, and a drainage engineer. Hmm. And then my dad asked me to go into business with him. So it was kind of, you know, learn the ropes first, get my feet, you know, a little wet in the engineering part of it, and then go into golf architecture.
Wow. And that evolved into Golf Design Group. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty remarkable when we first started talking about the concept of a golf course as kind of a living, breathing piece of art. I'm curious how the concept of making a functional piece of art combines with kind of the technical and the architectural side of beginning to dream up the way a golf course should look.
That you just have hit the nail right on the head where the difficulty of being able to obtain that is, because anybody can dream up wild landforms and crazy lakes and big greens and all that stuff. I mean, a lot of people design, you know, things on their napkins and on their little their little pieces of paper at home. But the key to it is to figure out within a budget. That's always one thing.
Sure.
You don't have unlimited funds within a budget to be able to design something that will accommodate, like you said, playing the game of golf, the maintenance of the game of golf, which has to do with growing grass and keeping things drained and being able to cut grasses at different heights throughout all different kinds of weather, and also to make the landforms attractive and meld into the existing ground. Mm. So it's a long process. And it's a combination of art and engineering, and it's the scale of it sometimes can be a little overwhelming.
Yeah, you were saying over 100 acres on this project alone.
Right, it was 160 acres on this project.
Wow.
And so, you know, you have to really dream big, and you have to really be able to visualize on a different level, you know, than, you know, an artist that may have a large canvas. You know, they have edges. I have edges too, but my edges aren't obvious, and I have to get everything to meld into the existing topography.
Yeah.
For example, like Purgatory Golf Club was 218 acres.
Wow.
And basically there I visualized an entire landscape first and then visualized the golf course to fit into that landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's a real challenge.
Yeah, well, and several of the golfers in my family that I've been talking to prior to coming here today have even said that even my worst day on the golf course is better than my best day in the office, you know, because
right.
'Cause even if I'm having a bad day of golf or a bad round of golf, I'm enjoying where I am. I'm enjoying the physical space of being on this course and in the setting that I'm in. And so for a lot of people, the aesthetics are just key, and the play almost comes second. But you do have to keep in mind all those different perspectives.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you bring that up, because there was a statement made one time that had a profound effect on me. It was made by Arnold Palmer in a dinner that I was attending that honored him. And he's always an everyman golf kind of guy. And he's like, you know, he goes, I don't ever want to hear something about a bad golf course. Because there is no such thing as a bad golf course. Mm. Anytime you can pull your car up, pull your golf clubs up, put on your spikes, and go out into nature and get away from everything for 2 to 4 hours.
Yeah.
He said it's a great place. So my job is to make it as enjoyable as possible and as challenging and strategic as possible for the players, so they thoroughly enjoy their recreational time. I still call golf the greatest game, because you can play it from age 5 until you're 95.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and take us a little bit through the process of getting that phone call from the owner of a golf club that says, hey, Ron, we really want you to come out here and reevaluate a few things and make some updates for us. Tell us a little bit about that process, and use Old Oakland as a case study if you'd like. I mean, we were just talking about how, even at this point, it's going to be about a year from kind of that first phone call and the planning through everything's looking good. Let's go try and get it around before winter gets here.
Correct. But you're right. That's what it basically starts at, is that, you know, they want me to do something, and then they, you know, I have an idea of what the budget is. And so I have that in my head. And then I basically go out and I start evaluating the existing golf course. I see what its strengths are. I see what its weaknesses are. And then it just kind of almost becomes a zen thing. And that's kind of where the art thing comes in. Because once you get a feel for it, and I've done this professionally now for 31 years, you just start to visualize changes that could be made and different options and all those. And, you know, for example, on one green side, I might look at 3 or 4 different ideas that I have and then try to figure out which is the best idea, what fits in the best, what's best for the strategy of the golf hole. And I also have to look at the strategy of the entire sequence of the golf course.
Sure.
So, I mean, I've got macro things to worry about, and I have micro things to worry about.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of almost becomes, like I said, a kind of a zen thing on working it all in. And then I do everything. I don't do anything on the computer. I do everything hand-drawn.
Wow, okay.
So that's part of the art of it, too. Everything's hand-drawn, no CAD, no computer-aided drafting.
Yeah.
And so when I'm out in the field, I have my notes, and I actually design everything out in the field while I'm looking at it. And then it goes back to the office, and I refine lines. I make changes to lines, and then I go back out in the field to make sure it works and refine it again.
Yeah.
So it's like, usually it's a 3-4-step process to get to my final design on every particular golf feature.
And where would a golf course designer go to play golf when he has his free afternoon off?
Well, I'll let my ego show a little bit. I'm going to go play one of my own golf courses. I'm probably going to go play Purgatory up in Noblesville. I play up there when I have a chance, and I also love to play the North Course at Pebblebrook in Noblesville, and then go around and play some of my other golf courses I've done throughout the state. My dad and I were pretty regional. We did a lot of work in Missouri, and we used to design golf courses for Hale Irwin. So there's like a nice one out in Boston. But yeah, I like to go. I'm a little egotistical. I like to go play my old golf courses, my dad's golf courses, or Bill Diddle's golf courses.
Contributor Pete Brown with photographer and golf course architect Ron Kern. Learn more about his golf course design at ronkerngolfarc.com and learn more about his photography at ronkernphotographer.com. Speaking of careers that inform each other, Liza Hyatt is both an art therapist and a poet. What began as a 3-page account of her grandmother's stories of the lives of her Irish great-great-grandparents' immigration to America blossomed into an unusual approach to genealogical storytelling in Liza's new book, Once There Was a Canal. She heard the family stories, collected them, and expanded them, tracing the very steps of her predecessors. Liza biked, walked, and drove the places of her ancestors until satisfied she could feel their journey during Indiana's canal era, and then she interpreted those stories in her poetry. She began our conversation with a reading of her poem, 2,000 Grandmothers.
40,000 years ago, an early human, possibly Neanderthal, pressed her palm against the rough, cool surface of a cave wall, and using her hand as the first stencil, blew through a hollow bone, a mouthful of paint, ground from iron oxide, mixed with clay, spit, animal fat, marrow, and blood. Through her, every 20 years or so, a new descendant, each new child touching the world with curious palms. 2,000 generations later, here are my hands, my fingers, my wrists, resting on the surface of a laptop, typing letters on the keyboard, shaping words to bring to life my great-great-grandmother's story. In a matriarchal chain, only 2,000 wombs between me and that first artist. Only 2,000 grandmothers. Imagine how quickly, how easily in our crowded world we could paint a subway wall with 2,000 handprints.
So I love this poem because it's a great window into or portal into the journey that you took. And I'm curious about what set you on that journey or that pilgrimage that resulted in both the physical travel and the poems that chart the physical travel.
Yeah. Well, I always have dreamed of making exotic pilgrimages in other countries. But I, you know, have a modest income and I can't afford to do that. But I do make journeys into people's stories all the time as an art therapist. I listen to people's life stories. And one day it dawned on me that I had a very short narrative that my grandmother had taken the time to put together about her grandparents, my great-great-grandparents. And I realized that I could make my pilgrimage right here in Indiana by bringing their lives to my imagination more fully, and that that might in some way help me understand the context of their lives in a way that would kind of free me from some of the fatigue and exhaustion of hearing therapy stories day in and day out. It would kind of open up the world and expand my perspective of how humans have dealt with suffering and struggle and things like that.
Did it work?
Yes, it was very, very renewing, very enlivening, and I began to really feel like the ancestors are here with us somehow, helping us, listening to us, and understanding their struggles as people who helped work on the Wabash and Erie Canal, Irish immigrants, very rough life. Their tenacity, their faith, their courage, their creativity, I feel like I've still got that in me and that they're helping me.
I don't know whether it's the poet part of you or the art therapist part of you that made sure that their lives weren't too romanticized. You talk about, you know, political struggles, disputes over who owns land, and the pain of childbirth and the desire to stay away from me. I've birthed 12 children and several of them have died and I'm tired.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Was that a conscious decision to invite in the grimy stuff?
Yeah, I felt like, I mean, partly because I've been a therapist, I know we all have grimy stuff. And then partly because to really make them human, to really imagine what they felt, I had to be empathic. I had to take those little passages from my grandmother's story that said she had 12 children and think, what was that like to have 12 children and to figure out, oh, well, five of them died before she did. And what was that like? What did she feel? And to really get into the blood and bones of their stories. I had to kind of get into those things.
She visited you and spent some time with you understanding, you know, what are you doing here? What is a computer? How does this work? And reassured you that life was equally complicated for you as it was for her.
Yes. Yeah, I started to feel like she was sitting in the car with me when I ran errands. And that was one of the things I needed. I needed some kind of confirmation that I, a divorced mother with one child, who complained often that I was exhausted and tired, would have understanding from someone in my ancestry that, yes, my life did have things that made me worthy of their struggle, that they saw me as carrying something on for them. And so her showing up and helping me pick books at the library and going to the farmer's market and things like that, really, I felt like she was saying, you're doing it. We're with you. You're doing it.
And you're part of the continuum so that your great-great-granddaughter can look back.
Yeah, exactly.
And the poem cycle is complete, but do you think you'll still summon your ancestors?
I will. And actually, in the course of working on this book, I discovered I have a second set of Irish great-great-grandparents that came to help build the Whitewater Canal. And I've researched some of their lives and have written a kind of a braided story that I'll need to figure out where to take that further. But I want to learn about my mother's ancestors, and just there's all kinds of, once you open this door into that realm, you can't leave.
Liza Hyatt's poems about her forebears' immigrant journey and lives in Indiana is called Once There Was a Canal. Learn more about the book and Liza's many other adventures at LizaHyatt.com. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Coming up, a local foundation that helps empower women and girls is the subject of a documentary. But right now, get your glass of milk handy for Eat Drink Indiana's Jolene Ketzenberger's conversation with Kate Drury of The Flying Cupcake.
How did it start?
Back in 2007, I had a women's clothing boutique, and I would make cupcakes for the open houses and things that we did there, and people seemed to really like it. I know it's a very simplistic way I started, but it kind of started my mind thinking, well, what if this could be a business? So that sort of planted the seed, and I started looking for locations, and I found the one in Butler Tarkington. And the landlord, he really wanted ice cream in there. So it was I had to like convince him. The idea of a cupcake shop, while now is so common, it was so foreign. So that whole concept seemed to be confusing to people. So when we opened in 07, it was an interesting first few months. I was initially I hired someone to do the baking, and I developed a lot of the recipes and then wanted them to execute it, but that didn't work out. It just wasn't working out, and so I ended up like, out the way, let me just do this. I'll just do it myself, which I think really provided me with a good foundation forward for these businesses. It gives me like a little more confidence because I don't bake anymore. I could. I don't think anybody in the kitchen would want me in there, but I could do it because I did do it for almost 2 solid years.
Well, now that was a very difficult time to be starting a business.
It was.
Right?
Well, it was 07, and so when everything crashed, I was already open, and I was actually in negotiations for a second location in Carmel, and the bank pulled the approval. That's next summer. So we didn't grow. It wasn't till I think it was 09 or 10 till I opened the second location at Mass Ave.
Right.
So I went a completely different direction, a much smaller space, pretty reasonable rent. And that's how that was my second location. And then I kind of did. We outgrew Illinois Street, the facilities for baking, and then hence the large kitchen that we have in Carmel, which is our commissary kitchen. And that was like a very big step. And then from then it just kind of grew. We just would like hear what customers would say, where they would maybe want another location. And yeah, I was 82nd, then Greenwood, right. Then the Donut, then Fisher's.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to talk about the Dancing Donut. Why another concept?
Well, like anyone else, I get bored too. And, you know, it is. It's like anything else. Like every single person you know who with their own job wants new challenges. And I am the same way. And that was what the donut was about. And I really wanted donuts made from scratch. And I wanted to see what it would look like in a landscape of doing it all from scratch. And that is like, I look at it almost like it's like a Broadway play every night. Those bakers come in at like 9 or 10 every night. And they produce, they're working on it, they hand mix it. They have a mixer, but it's like all done by hand. Roll it, cut it, they hand cut it. It's all done that way, all from scratch. And then we open at 7 with the donuts on display for the big show. It's the same thing every night. So,
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that idea. What a cool comparison. Now, what about the Lemon Bar in Zionsville? That's something different.
Completely.
From the other shops.
Yeah. So again, good old Kate gets bored. So I thought, I really love Zionsville. We had the donuts set up at the farmers market. Zionsville has a really strong community feel where they're very supportive of their own businesses. Not every area is like that. Certain areas I have found, at least in my experience, are more supportive than others. So from a business perspective, I thought something could succeed there. What? I had to kind of think that through. They have some really nice bakeries there already. Sure. So I wanted to bring that element in, but I definitely wanted to add food. And we have so many skilled and talented bakers that have gone to culinary school that work for us anyway, that dialogue happened. And from there, the concept grew and the menu kept evolving. And the next thing I knew, I woke up one day and I'm like, huh, I feel like I own a restaurant. So that's kind of how it all played out. And I really, really love it. It's still very challenging, but I'm not bored at all yet.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indies Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Gamble, and still to come, the Harrison Center's mission is evolving. But right now, the Indianapolis-based Women Like Us Foundation helps empower girls and women around the world. One of their missions caught the eye of a cinematographer, and next month the group debuts a thought-provoking documentary on their outreach. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer recently learned more. Tell us about this.
This is a really exciting film for the Women Like Us Foundation, and it happened completely by accident. The cinematographer had volunteered to become part of the group, and while she was part of the group, she just started rolling her camera, and the next thing you know, a couple of years go by, and they have all these great stories. And co-founder Linda Rendleman is excited to share those stories with everyone in February when the documentary debuts here in Indianapolis, and I got to talk with her a little bit about it.
As we started filming, and there was such beauty over there and so many amazing stories and all of the amazing work that these women are doing there, that it just grew into a 1 hour, 30-minute documentary. I'm not kidding you. There was just so much to talk about and so much to tell and so much to share, you know?
Were you surprised at the reaction from the women over there, that they were so open and ready to tell their story to you?
You know, It was different with each one. We have three women that we support there, and let me also say that the documentary is also about the work we do in the United States, so it expanded into this whole piece. Some were more willing than others. Some were wondering what we were doing and the fact that they were even in front of the camera. But, you know, overall, and we had 20 women traveling with us as well, and they're in the documentary for the Kenya part. You know, overall, they just really kind of settled into it and didn't notice because we were doing so much work and having so much fun with the kids and so forth. So it really wasn't bad, huh? They haven't seen any of themselves on film yet, though.
Well, one of the scenes in the documentary is with a mother and her children, and they all have AIDS.
Yes.
And her story just seems hopeless. But yet in the documentary, she doesn't really seem that way. It's an interesting thing to see for someone from, you know, we're far away from it.
Right.
And the documentary really takes us literally right into their home, and you see how they live. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of almost a way of life for some of them. And
it's an acceptance.
Yeah, that's the word. Yes.
Yeah, it's an acceptance of their plight or their story. And interestingly enough, those two little boys in that interview, when we went back this time, Eddie, the little guy, has full-blown AIDS now. So it's also a real reality test, you know, to really say this is what goes on in the world.
Yeah.
And we like to take teen girls with us because they really get an opportunity to have their eyes opened, and they always just, you know, come back and do things, whether it's at their school or whatever. But the importance of seeing what's on going on in the world and how you can help is good.
The times that you've been there, too, as well, and as you're talking about things that have improved and changed, has the overall mindset and the spirit maybe, is there hope to get away from that feeling of acceptance among the people there, that maybe they can find a way to be healthier?
I don't know that I've seen that with regard to AIDS, but I will tell you that another woman that we support is Kim DeWitt. And she has a charity called the Omaleka Home. And what they do is, what she does, rather, is she brings in girls that are victims of female genital mutilation. Hers has grown over the last 3 years from 25 girls to 37. And there is becoming in some, especially if you read Molly Melching's book, However Long the Night, which is fabulous. She's doing some she's from Illinois, actually. Mm-hmm. But she's over there, and she's doing some fabulous work on education through women, helping them realize that their human rights are, they don't have to have this done to them. And they didn't realize they could say no. So with that education and understanding more about their bodies, and enlightening the men in some of these tribes, it really has changed.
You know, we talk about there's a lot of outreach. A lot of organizations and groups go over to Kenya and Africa to do a lot of work. And that really is what sets women like us apart, because you really do go to the heart of the basic needs of a woman. That sometimes we here in America, in our very comfortable lives, we forget about that. We don't peel back our layers enough.
Truly.
We never had to suffer with those kinds of things.
I know.
And so we were automatically elevated up. And over there, you're really seeing the base, but you're also seeing improvement, that good things can happen as well. And I think that's the other part of the documentary, is it's not all horrible things. It's like, you really are making a difference. You really can make a difference.
And that's why we did it. That's really why we wanted to do this. And the message, hopefully it comes across, I think it does, is that you too can make a difference, whether it's holding the hand of a child walking across the street, or doing something in your neighborhood, your community to help, or, you know, certainly around the world. So, and the women's stories, the first part is about Africa and our work there. And women there, not just our work, but women that are doing great things. And then the second half, we cover the three pillars of the foundation, which is sex trafficking and education and homelessness. And those all really intertwine. They really do. With sex trafficking, you know, you need education. Sex trafficked people are homeless, or homeless girls typically are trafficked. So it really does all work together. So we cover that's going on right here in the United States as well.
That was my other thing to ask about as well, that the more you guys have done over there, the more you've probably learned of what you still need to do here.
Completely, completely. That's exactly right. So it's a big bite to chew, but at the same time, we were bigger. So we keep narrowing down and narrowing down. And one of the things that's real, that the way we've designed our work also, is we don't just go from person to person to person. Like, what we do is we raise the money so that we can grant back to them to keep them sustainable. And then we like to take volunteers so that they can also work on the ground and really, you know, see what the needs are. But we really do feel like when we get someone that we want to support, we don't just do it once. We do it at least for 3 years, because it's about sustainability.
The documentary Women Like Us, Three Journeys, One Mission to Change the World, debuts on Sunday, February 25th at the IMAX Theater downtown. This is going to be pretty spectacular. At 5 o'clock, they have a VIP red carpet, a meet and greet, and the film will air at 6:30. And then afterwards at 8 o'clock, they are going to have a Q&A with the cinematographer who shot the documentary, and Linda will be there as well, and possibly some of the other people that were featured in the film, too. All for a good cause, the Women Like Us, and tickets are available online and through the IMAX Theater.
Big story on a big screen. Mm-hmm. That seems highly appropriate.
It'd be a wonderful way to show it.
Yeah.
IMAX experience.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we have lots of big news and other entertainments in our calendar that we call
What Will We Do?
Years ago, there was a TV commercial, and the tagline was, "When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen." In Indianapolis, you could translate that to "When the Lilly Endowment talks, people listen," and they recently announced a new initiative called Strengthening Indianapolis Through Arts and Cultural Innovation. It's a competitive grant initiative that aims to give grants totaling up to $25 million to support compelling projects that strengthen Indianapolis's cultural vitality. They're hosting information centers at their headquarters at the Lilly Endowment on January 25th, the 30th, and also February 7th. And if you want to know more about that, you can go to lillyendowmentarts.org.
And the 10th West Gallery, that's that new collective of seasoned artists here in Indianapolis in the Stutz Building. They're going to start their Saturday hours starting on January the 20th. They'll be open from noon to 4. And a lot of those days, they will have an artist there that they're going to be featured, giving a little talk while you come and see the art there as well. And coming up on Thursday, January the 25th, they are having, it's called the Wine Hole event from 4 to 8 p.m. And this is a traveling wine van where you can actually purchase wine to sample and enjoy while you take a look at the exhibit inside. And the wine van is going to be parked right inside that Bearcat Alley there in the Stutz Building downtown. So if you like wine, it's a good reason
to
go.
If
you like
art,
it's a good reason to go. And it's a Thursday, so it's another good reason to get out so you can go see everything else you want to see on Friday and Saturday. That's at the 10th West Gallery.
Well, you might have discovered this if you spent a little extra time in Carmel when you visited Chris Kindlemart over the holidays. But just in case you missed it, Indiana Artisan has a new store in the Carmel Arts and Design District. Reminder, Indiana Artisan is that statewide initiative where creators of small batch, all kinds of things, small batch, visual arts, textiles, wine, beer, food. It's a juried program. You have to work hard to get in the program, but Indiana Artisan Store is now carrying the work of about 105 of these artists and fine crafters and foodists, as they're called. It is in the former Inspire Gallery space next to Joe's Butcher Shop at 111 West Main Street, and I'm sure your GPS will take you right there. And can I just say Valentine's Day is coming?
Sooner than we think.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, speaking of love, a love supreme, it's time once again for Rob Dixon, the mayor of jazz here in the Indianapolis city of Indianapolis. A musician is going to be presenting John Coltrane's Love Supreme album at the Jazz Kitchen. That takes place on Sunday, January 21st at 7 o'clock. Steve Ali, Steve Hutton, Ernest Stewart, and Jim Anderson are all going to be joining him. If you're a fan of Coltrane, you've heard this music before, but it never goes out, and it is especially kind of romantic, gets you in the mood, because you're right, Valentine's Day is just around the corner.
Well, a very different kind of mood will be invoked on stage at Beef and Boards when they start their 45th anniversary season with Mamma Mia. Yep. Swedish supergroup ABBA hits, including Dancing Queen, Take a Chance on Me, Honey Honey, and Mamma Mia, all part of the plot and the fun. And don't forget, when you go to Beef and Boards, you get dinner and a show. That opens up February 1st and runs through April 8th.
The Indianapolis Zoo has released its calendar of events for the upcoming year. And in addition to the butterfly kaleidoscope's going to be again there again, their Elegant Vintages International Wine Auction is March the 24th. They have a naturally inspired paint out day in April. Zoopolis is back around the time of the Indy 500 on May the 23rd. And Zubilation, June the 8th. I guess try to get your ticket now, because we all know the moment they put them on sale, they sell out. But this is your pre-warning here, 6 months in advance, to get your ticket to Zubilation on June the 8th at the Indianapolis Zoo.
And if you haven't heard something you need to do, don't forget you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or listen to us again next week for that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. In a few minutes, Butler University pushes its MFA students to use their skills to make the world a better place. But first, if you go out to downtown Indy's First Fridays, you've certainly visited the Harrison Center for the Arts. Since 2001, the organization, located in a former church at 16th and Delaware, has supported individual visual artists and helped to build a community of artists as well. But the Harrison Center recently updated its mission and name and is now, quoting here, a community-based nonprofit arts organization that seeks to be a catalyst for renewal in the city of Indianapolis. I invited the Harrison Center's executive director, Joanna Taft, to talk about that change and what they aspire to accomplish.
I have to ask, at Pre-Enact Indy, did you already know you were evolving your mission? Or did you evolve your mission because of Pre-Enact Indy and its successes?
No, we knew that our mission was evolving, and we were struggling with how to talk about it. People would say, why is the Harrison Center for the Arts doing these different neighborhood community development type activities? Mm-hmm. And we really felt like it made sense because the Harrison Center is for the arts, and it's also for the city, and the arts and the city work go hand in hand. And so we were struggling with how to talk about it, mm-hmm. and we finally had the idea that maybe we were the Harrison Center for the arts and for the city.
It seems so logical when you say it out loud now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I should ask you to, for people who maybe weren't in town or didn't get to experience, what was Pre-Enact Indy?
Pre-Enact Indy was a theater performance, kind of, if you can imagine, a reenactment at Connor Prairie, perhaps. We did a pre-enactment, and we partnered with 13 theater companies, and the set designers built temporary buildings. We actually built 10 temporary buildings on vacant lots, and we activated abandoned buildings, and the actors acted out an equitable way of living. And there was diversity, and there was equity, and there was inclusion. And so we wanted people to be able to try on a new way of living, try on a different way of relating to each other in a different way of revitalizing a neighborhood while still being inclusive.
And that's what the arts are perfect for, and that's what they're about. I mean, almost no art making happens in a vacuum. It's always in some kind of context, right?
Right. You know, and we hadn't done theater before, so for the Harrison Center, it was an amazing opportunity for us to grow and to learn and to partner with the arts.
What surprised you most about working with theater?
Well, I think, I hate to tell you this, but I feel like I learned more about how much I need to change personally and how I need to pre-enact, how I need to do more. And I think that the theater partnership helped me see more things about myself as a person where I need to grow.
But if you're feeling that, think of all the constituents you touched who are also
right.
feeling that.
Right. Here's the funny thing. I wanted to tell everybody else how to change.
I see.
And I knew theater would help them,
yeah.
you know. So the surprising thing for me was that I found out I needed to change too.
Physician, heal thyself,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
And you are kind of continuing with this idea of that intersection between the arts and how we live and how we might picture how we live with Lyft through Monon 16. Tell us about where Monon 16 neighborhood is.
Yeah, so the Monon 16 neighborhood is where the Monon and 16th Street intersect, and mm-hmm. it's the quarter of a mile around that intersection. And the city, just after Pre-Enact Indy, announced that Monon 16 was selected as a Lyft neighborhood, mm-hmm. and they'd be investing $4.5 million into that neighborhood for inclusive development. And this was just a beautiful thing for us to hear. And the Harrison Center was chosen as the placemaking partner. And so we will be working in that neighborhood
to elevate long-term resident stories, elevate long-term businesses' stories, and celebrate the neighborhood history so that when new people move in, they'll feel like they're invited into an existing story, not into a blank slate. Mm. And so being able to share the beautiful story of that neighborhood and to connect old and new neighbors through the arts will be a lot of our work in the next 3 years.
A scary part of this sounds as though it's just you and your team getting in touch with a new set of artists and new kinds of people with maybe some different skills than you've worked with in the past.
I think that we are I think that the partnerships are growing, and it's teaching us new skills as well.
The Harrison Center's Joanna Taft. The organization will continue to be home to 36 artist studios and 5 galleries, even as it expands into community development and using arts and culture to tell the story of Indy's urban neighborhoods. Find out more at harrisoncenter.org, and you can see video about Lift Indy there, too. Speaking of artists reaching into their communities, Butler University believes that you can't be an effectively working artist without engaging your community in a generative and caring way. In response to that call, their MFA program created Writing in the Schools for underserved kids in Broad Ripple and Shortridge High Schools. Butler Bridge, an after-school program for students grades 3 to 12 on Butler's campus. And Writing for Wellness, a program that deploys students to senior homes, hospitals, a women's prison, and more. I invited Writing in the Schools' Chris Speckman, Butler Bridge's Mindy Dunn, and Writing for Wellness's Emma Huddleston to talk about why it's crucial for writers to engage with the broader community.
So, Chris, I'm turning to you to give us kind of the big picture view of when did Butler realize, hey, it's time to figure out how to do more outreach and take all of our fabulous literary potential in our students and put it out into the community? Is that a fair assessment of the
program? Yeah. It's something that I think there was always this consideration of ways to reach out to the community from the very time that I started in the master's program myself, which would have been around 2010. I got involved really early with a program that was spearheaded by a mentor of mine, Susan Sutherland. And she had this idea of kind of instituting the Writing in the Schools model, which was popularized in the New York public schools by Kenneth Koch, and has kind of affiliations all over the country now. But she wanted to bring this to Indianapolis public schools, and she wanted to get the master's program involved. And I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and we were able to start this up. This is this will be our 7th full year of the Writing the Schools program. We've been at Shortridge for almost the duration of the whole time, and then also expanded to Broad Ripple High School as well. So it's something that has really kind of changed my life, getting involved with community writing and bringing creative writing into public schools. It's been rewarding. It's been it's shaped my work in all these interesting ways, too. And it's also sort of given us this footing to build out and expand our service programming with the rest of the MFAs. And I think being able to present the opportunity to incoming poets and fiction writers who are interested in getting a degree but also don't want to just kind of sit at a desk by themselves. And we sort of see this as the writer's life.
No ivory tower, huh?
Right. There's no ivory tower, but also not just, as social as writers seem to get sometimes is it's going to Starbucks and putting your headphones on. Mm-hmm. But being completely kind of unaware or disinterested in actually conversing about what you're doing or being social, communicating with others. And I love the fact that this MFA has become something that is kind of completely the opposite of that, which is using writing as this platform to connect with other people.
Yeah, so our program actually, we're going to be in our 10th anniversary this year. And from the very beginning, we put service as one of our requirements for our students. So everybody that goes through has to do some type of service. So all of our students have had great service opportunities from the beginning. And it's really one of the jewels of our program. You know, we have a great academic program, just like a lot of other creative writing programs, but our service is really sort of one of the jewels.
And Mindy, it's the right thing to do, but it strikes me also that it's resume enhancing.
Resume enhancing, yes, absolutely. Nowadays, a lot of our students coming through don't always necessarily end up teaching in academic classrooms. So teaching in the community in different ways is very valuable for them.
Yeah. Emma, we think of writing as healing, but normally when someone speaks of that, it's maybe morally, spiritually. It might even be physically, though. Tell us about Writing for Wellness.
Yes, absolutely. So Writing for Wellness is another one of the wonderful service initiatives of the MFA program at Butler. And it hinges on the idea that creative writing can heal trauma, that creative writing can improve immune function, that it can build community, that it can relieve stress and promote relaxation. And so it's been a newer service initiative of the program. We've only been up and running for, Mindy might be able to say exactly, a couple of years now?
I think 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So going on 3 or 4 years now. And we've been into places as diverse as the Indiana Women's Prison, Eskenazi Hospital, Riley Children's Hospital, Fairbanks, American Senior Villages. And we have a list of, Indiana Youth Group, yeah, over a dozen places that we've been throughout the city.
Mindy Dunn of Butler Bridge, Chris Speckman of Writing in the Schools, and Emma Huddleston of Writing for Wellness. Those are just 3 of the outreach programs Butler University has created to get its students into their communities. Learn more at butler.edu/MFA. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks 5 songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here today with an extraordinary vocalist and composer named Hannah Benn. She has an amazing new EP out. It's called Divide, and you can go to her website, hannahbenn.com, to learn more. Hannah, do you want to say a quick word about this EP? It's your first EP. Anything you want to say about this work?
Divide is the name of the EP, and it should be released in early January 2018, and it is a collection of tone poems.
Put you on the spot here today, and you agreed to share 5 songs with us, 5 songs that have influenced you or that are favorites. How would you frame these?
I would say that these are, again, ongoing inspirations, some performed by my friends, created by my friends, things that inspire me.
And what's your first choice for us?
I would like to play a piece by producer and composer D'Antoni Parks.
And number 2.
I would like to play a movement from Peter Grimes, Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes, the interlude On the Beach.
Number 3.
I would like to play a piece by Robbie Basho, Blue Crystal Fire.
Blue Crystal Fire. sunshine, smooth singing sunshine, wrap your blanket round me, wrap your blanket round me, round me, I love.
And your fourth pick.
Let's play 5 years from Bjork's Homogenic.
Yeah. Are you a big Bjork fan?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Me too.
Huge.
Sing children, I'm your something. Well, I've got plenty. You're the one who's missing out. But you won't notice until after 5 years. If you live that long, you'll wake up.
Number five, your final song, Hannah.
Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder, okay. Do you have a favorite Stevie Wonder album, song?
Music of My Mind. Let's do something fun.
Okay.
Light. Happier Than the Morning Sun.
Great.
By Stevie Wonder.
I'm happier than the morning sun. That's the way you said that it would be. If I should ever bring you inside my life, I'm happier than the morning sun. And that's the way you said that it would be. If I should ever bring you inside my life.
And Hannah, your new EP, your debut EP, is titled Divide, and folks can go to your website, hannabin.com, to find out more information on how to get a copy or listen to it online. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Every day I search for the stars.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown and Jill Dittmeyer. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, a documentary about a crime that held Indianapolis spellbound in 1977, plus conservationist Meg Lohman, and how librarians deal with music on formats that are no longer supported. It's The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.